Welcome to this podcast brought to you from the Small Wonder Short Story Festival 2013. The Charleston Trust have joined forces with Thresholds, the online international short story forum hosted by the University of Chichester, to record these special discussions on the short story form. I'm Catherine Orr, and I'll be talking to the poet, translator, and short story writer David Constantine about his latest collection of stories, Tea at the Midland, the title story of which won the 2010 BBC National Short Story Award. Thank you, David, very much for joining us. We're going to start by hearing just the opening page of the story, Tea at the Midland, the title story of your collection.
The wind blew steadily hard with frequent surges of greater ferocity that shook the vast plate glass behind which a woman and a man were having tea. The waters of the bay, quite shallow, came in slant at great speed from the southwest. They were breaking white on a turbid ground far out, tide and wind driving them, line after line, nothing opposing or impeding them, so they came on and on until they were expended. The afternoon winter sky was torn and holed by the wind, and a troubled golden light flung down at all angles, abiding nowhere, flashing out and vanishing. And under that ceaselessly riven sky, riding the furrows and ridges of the sea, were a score or more of surfers towed on boards by kites. You might have said they were showing off, but in truth it was a self-delighting among others doing likewise. The woman behind plate glass could not have been in their thoughts. They were not performing to impress and entertain her. Far out they rode on the waves, or sheer, or at an angle through them, and always only to try what they could do. In the din of waves and wind under that ripped open sky, they were enjoying themselves. They felt the life in them to be entirely theirs, to deploy how they liked best. To the woman watching, they look like grace itself, the heart and soul of which is freedom. It pleased her particularly that they were attached by invisible strings to colourful curves of rapidly moving air. How clean and clever that was. You throw up something like a handkerchief, you tether it, and by its headlong wish to fly away, you are towed along. And not in the straight line of its choosing. No, you tack and swerve as you please and swing out wide around at least a hemisphere of centrifugans. Beautiful, she thought. Such versatile autonomy among the strict determinants, and all that coordination of mind and body, fitness, practice, confidence, skill and execution, all for fun. The man had scarcely noticed the surf riders. He was aware of the crazed light and the shocks of wind, chiefly as irritations. All he saw was the woman, and that he had no presence in her thoughts. So he said again, "A paedophile is a paedophile. That's all there is to it."
Thank you. We were just discussing before beginning what a listener who hadn't read the story might need to know. And the main thing is that it's the story of a relationship.
Yes, it's that, and it takes... that they are having tea in this really quite famous hotel that does indeed have a frieze by Eric Gill, who for his private life was notorious, but was also an artist of very, very great skill and competence, genius even. Mm. In fact, he offered the Midland an earlier version of something for the frieze, and they turned that down as being really too indecent, so he had to try again with this, the one that is there, which is in no way indecent. It's very classical in its pose. So they're there and they're having an argument, and the way people do in arguments, the thing they're discussing is in a sense nominal. It's that around which the argument is forming very bitterly. Mm-hmm. So the story isn't a sort of disquisition on the morality, amorality or immorality of art and the relationship between the artist and his or her work. It's about a man and a woman having a very serious argument, and that is the occasion.
Mm. It seems to me that... And in fact, one of the reasons I wanted to choose this story in particular to talk about, or to frame the collection, I suppose, is throughout the collection, in so many of the stories, you are passionately involved with narrative, the stuff of narrative, competing narratives, the sort of a very strong sense of a heritage and old and new narratives joining forces, clashing, awkward juxtapositions. And that can happen within a single story, which happens in Tea at the Midland.
Yeah.
On several levels, you have a number of narratives running through the story. And also, in many of the other stories as well, you have, well, certainly between two, you have a kind of an interlinked approach to stories where a character from one seems to reappear in another. So there's a sense of, I suppose, breaking through the boundary of narratives within your own collection. And I wondered if we could talk a little bit about that in terms of what it is the short story form can do because of its compression and because of its sense of engagement with narrative.
But by narratives in this, you're meaning the various stories that are in play within the story.
Yeah. The various histories and various storylines playing out.
That's right. I read the story Asylum in Cork, actually, and somebody in the audience pointed out what something I suppose kind of felt was there are actually a lot of different stories, not just the obvious one between the elderly man and the girl, but his bereavement, his daughter, and the two friends, and the friend's interest in him, and so on and so forth. So, I probably also, I've talked about short stories rather a lot, actually. I mean, I don't mean that I object to this in the least, but, no, not in the least. It's just that I've discussed short stories now with other writers, and I recognise my way of going about it to be quite different from a lot of other people's. And there's one chief difference, which is I honestly don't know at the outset where it's going or what's going to be in it. Whereas I sat with writers on platforms, certain ones, who actually have already written the last sentence and sometimes won't start writing until it's all planned.
Which is completely different.
And that's totally different because... So if there are these narratives which compete or overlap or so forth, they come into being as I make sentences.
Yeah.
And I'm making sentences out of, I think in every case in this collection and probably in the others as well, out of some completely concrete situation, without which I would not have started the story in the first place.
Mm.
It's the same way that I try to write poems or that I ever feel I'm going to be able to. I can only begin them as the short stories if a situation presents itself so concretely that it is itself and it is also figurative. So I'm interested in... It's something that people have said about Kafka. He uses this phrase, literal metaphor, which things which are themselves, they really are themselves, and they're not pointing beyond themselves, but the metaphorical significance of them.
It's so strong.
It's embedded in it. So in this, the starting point was quite simply that, the plate glass and I suppose first of all the kite surface and that being an image of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suppose that then as an idea gets discussed in the unfreedom of this relationship because they are both bound elsewhere. And that comes in writing. Mm-hmm. It's not as though I'd worked out beforehand what is going to play.
Well, it's very interesting talking about freedom in relation to a form which is so tightly bound and where so much can be happening and such. And this story is five
pages? It's very short.
It's very short.
It's not even 2,000 words.
Yeah. And there's so much at work that there are such dynamics at play. And yet, in a way, you're suggesting that happens unconsciously. That...
Well, it happens in the process of writing. Mm. I mean, I think of writing as a process, not a... To me, the word realisation is useful. That is to say, as when one reads, you realise things in the sense that things dawn on you.
Mm.
And as when you write, things dawn on you.
Mm.
But another sense of realise is to make real. That is to say, by the sentences, you are making real that which is in the mind and in the feelings as something that's amorphous, and it's only by making sentences that you give these things a form and a shape. So you are realizing them in that sense as they dawn on you.
Mm.
As they, I mean, it's, you know, most, I don't want to be mystical about this, it's kind of almost physical teasing of sense out of a thing which is to me compellingly interesting, the situation, this very concrete image.
It's interesting that you say physical, because one of the words that jumped out at me was the word queasy, which comes up halfway through the story. And I was thinking about that in relation to what the short story can do at its most powerful, which is, and I really think it happens here several times, there are these very queasy moments for the reader where you're drawing elements together, which don't sit comfortably.
No,
you have this
don't.
Incredibly graceful opening, and then suddenly we're into paedophilia. Yeah. And then we realise that there's this horrible tension going on between this couple.
Yeah.
It's not a sedate tea at all. And then towards the bottom of the third page, as part of their conversation, he says to her, "You turn everything wrongly." And she answers, "No, I'm trying to think the way you seem to want me to think, joining everything up so that I don't concentrate on one thing without bringing in everything else."
Mm.
And I think that says so much about that again, the compression and the conflation of elements and the tensions that are really roiling in a short story that's doing its work.
Yeah.
But there's a tremendous sense of activity, and there is something quite visceral about the response one can have.
Yes, I think that's true, and the form allows that.
Mm.
And it is because these things they're coming at you quite quickly.
Mm.
And in a sense, a lot of it is teased out of the image of this, of the surfers with their management of these forces.
Mm.
Whereas the sea itself, you know, is, as it is mentioned later with the cockle pickers, is the undoing of life, whereas the surfers are enjoying that. So these things, they coexist.
Mm.
And I suppose it's because there's so much going on. I don't mean that's particularly skillful, but it just is the fact that there's more than you can handle, really. But it's quite often the way in rows that one is really rather inchoate.
Mm.
You know that there's something, as you just use the word, viscerally antagonistic going on. And it battens on an image or as I said before, as an occasion. But it's actually, now, that doesn't subsume it. There's more. It's kind of washing around
other
and it's
things.
Fragmented.
Yeah.
So there are ideas, and that's why I think, you know, some people are quite interested in discussing whether it is possible to live in the way that she says she wants to live.
Mm-hmm.
Because she says later, you know, "I wouldn't be allowed to watch these people before I made sure they weren't a member of the National Front."
Yeah.
And in a sense, that's true. But in another sense, you can't live like that.
No.
But when, so they're having a quite interesting conversation, and if they were friends, you could have an interestingly, the conflicting views.
You could unpack it all.
Say on the one hand this, on the other hand that, like a guardian leader, you know. So it's not really like that. So
there's too much at work under the surface in where they're coming from.
And also, that's not really the issue. The issue is his rather hapless, rather helpless, really, rage and possessiveness. I mean, he can't bear to have her thinking, you know, enjoying the freedom, which is a sort of quasi-freedom, you know, it's freedom a bit like that of the kite surfers, but which he doesn't like. But he comes across, as men often do, I think, and he's just as rather outclassed by that, because he hasn't got the words to do it.
There's great humour in the final page where you work towards a really lovely simplicity in the final couple of lines where it's a man explaining to a child the freeze, and you write, "The lady admitted she would have liked to marry him, but he already had a wife at home, so they rowed him home." And there was something so beautifully ironic as well, that just a few lines earlier, there's a conversation between the couple where he's insisting that she never cries about him.
Yeah.
And yet she's been speaking at length about this narrative.
About Odysseus.
Of Odysseus.
Yeah.
And
it's pretty
clear that there are parallels here. And it's quite wonderful that it just passes him by. And
yes, well, I think probably that it will always be the case, won't it, that there's more going on than the characters in the story are fully conscious of. But he is, in a rather pitiable fashion, he's sort of lagging behind. I didn't know it was going to finish with the man on his knees with his arm around the little girl. And things have come to such a pass nowadays, actually. You know, there are fathers and grandfathers feel queasy about picking up their daughters and granddaughters from primary school, and kids falling over and men hurrying instinctively to lift them up. And
I hadn't thought of that.
But it is rather nasty. So and he's on his knees, and he's a big man.
Yeah.
And he's got his arm around this, presumably his daughter, but it might not be his daughter, but he is simply explaining in a way which is, as it were, perfectly natural, and what an older person might do to a younger person. He's being instructive. He's telling her, and he's telling her in terms of... And then on top of that is this adult world of mess, really, in some ways.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you decide where to end a short story, because so often there's so much going on. There are so many cross currents, as it were, that there are many places that in theory you could end.
Well, my great model is Lawrence in this. That is to say that when a Lawrence story finishes, it there's no ever, there's no sense of it all being tied in a knot.
And
there's no, I hate this word, but there's no closure, because the closure doesn't exist in real life, and therefore a fiction shouldn't do it either.
No.
So where you end should... The ones I like best are where there is physically a sort of opening up as it ends. And that one I quite like, because it's left everything in play, really. In a sense, the man with his arm around the little girl explaining the classical story is another thing which we might now put back in.
There's a sort of awful circularity in that.
She's right when she says Odysseus is a monster, actually, in terms of his behaviour. And yet, the thing that moves me most is in the story itself about the islanders who's...
The grace in their behaviour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They do it anyway without regard to deserts, and this swine of a god punishes them, so they stop doing it.
I believe I'm right in saying that you've described yourself as primarily a poet who also writes short stories.
Well, that's true. That I have written stories for a long time, actually, since I was at university, since I was 20, 21 or something like that. And I started writing poems 4 or 5 years before that. So I have always written stories, but it's only the last 10, 15 years that I suppose I've written more, and part of that is accidental. It's having a publisher who's very, who's an enthusiast for the short stories, and Comma Press was set up to publish short stories. I don't say I wouldn't be writing them anyway, I would. But I can write poems 3 or 4 times a year, and that is to say that most of the time I'm hanging around in that sense. I mean, I've got plenty else to do, but they're not biddable, but then nor are these stories biddable. I've sometimes written to... The Asylum story was written as a commission from Amnesty to go with in their anthology of Declaration of Human Rights, celebration of that. But I could only write it because I've done nearly 20 years of teaching, or to call it that, at least trying to help kids in this unit in the hospital to write. And it then chimed in with the whole idea of asylum, which I've been thinking about for years, really, about what is a hospital, what is a psychiatric hospital, what is, and then asylum and all the rest of it. So I can only answer these commissions if they just slot in, or disturb something that's already there. So their coming into being is very similar, poems and stories. It's true the stories are longer, and I have to keep at it longer until it's finished. But the other way, and more interesting way in which they're similar, is, as I said earlier, is just this, the concreteness of the central image. I can't begin a poem unless I can hear a tone of voice, and the equivalent to that in the story is a tone of voice in a bit of dialogue. I've got to be able to feel and hear what this man and woman, what their tones of voice are like
So a sense of character.
Well, the character is in the voice.
But, yeah.
Because I don't think I describe them at all in this.
No.
I mean, which I don't say what they look like. Yeah. So it's, for me, it's in the tone of voice and the expression of character through a kind of nominal argument.
Yes, the woman is she throughout, isn't she?
Yes.
And that's very interesting as well, that one can get away with unnamed characters.
Well, if it's quite short, you can. And if you're not introducing another... I mean, this is a technical matter. If you introduce somebody else who matters...
Then it gets complicated. With dialogue.
Yeah.
But with in terms of execution, are there differences that you're very conscious of between writing... poems and writing short stories?
There's a generic difference, which is pretty fundamental, actually. I have occasionally, on two or three occasions, I think, written a poem and then written a story, or written a story and then written a poem, out of a particularly, I mean, I can tell you it's not in that one, it's in the one before called In Another Country, which is a story of the girl in the ice. A friend of mine told me about the glaciers retreating at Chamonix, and that they'd found then, as in a deep crevasse, the body of a guide who'd gone down a crevasse in the 1920s, 30s, and he was a young man in the uniform of a guide, which is odd enough, because he'd been completely preserved in the ice. But the spooky thing is that they then fetched his son, now an 80-year-old man, up from the village to view his father as a young man. And that really did haunt me. Interestingly, not very long ago, I saw the film of, my wife and I saw the film of Camus' autobiographical novel, Le Premier Homme, which starts with him going to the graves and seeing the grave of a young man. His father was killed in the first year of the war, I think, first or second. So there's this son who's outgrown the father now by the best part of 20 years. And that's because when I read that story in Germany, actually, and somebody said, then, have you seen Le Premier Homme? And I hadn't at that point, but it's one of these sort of dislocations of natural order.
Yeah.
But in the Chamonix story, it is absolutely concrete. There's a physical preserved presence of a son.
That's extraordinary.
It's said that it drove the man mad to see it. So. No, that kind of haunted me. I wrote a poem about it, and I wrote this extended story about it, in the feeling that there's an awful lot in it, actually.
Was there a difference? Were you conscious of a different treatment?
Yes, very, because the story was about an old man and his wife, who were childless. And in my story, the girl in the ice was pregnant, and his wife, the wife of the man, who was childless. It's as though, well, she actually says something in the story. I mean, I might have hoped to get through without stuff like this, but... At the very end of their lives, you know, they're in their 70s, 80s or something, suddenly there's this thing comes up from the past, and it's not in the same league, but that is very Laurentian, when something is thrust at you to deal with, which is brutal, really.
Mm.
And Lawrence's characters, sometimes it completely crushes them. It's like one of his images is a kind of carapace, which is smashed.
Mm.
And the characters that he cares most about, mostly women actually, somehow they sort of fight their way through onto another level of consciousness. Because that's what it's all about, really. It's just this consciousness of, you know, a full awareness, living in the consciousness of things. And sometimes it's completely destructive and they can't handle it. And so I needed more space and I made up a story.
And time, were you conscious of time playing a central role in that, because the brutality of what you describe,
it's as though in a very real sense, I'm sure you've thought of this yourself, is that there is only one tense in poetry, and really in fiction as well, and that's the present tense. I mean, you can use the past tense of Pooper Fate, you can use all the tenses you like, but actually the reading experience is always present. It's there in you. When your heart starts to pound, or when you start to weep, or you clench your fists or whatever, that's happening in a narrative which may go back and forward and to and fro like that. But the actual presence of it is in the present tense, in you as you read.
Well, and you're being forced to live those sort of temporal leaps.
That's right.
In a simultaneous,
that's right.
In an odd simultaneous way.
Yes, it's very
way,
weird.
Which it goes back to the queasy feelings.
Well, that's right. I think. And then in that story, In Another Country, then it is absolutely, I mean, it's 60 years ago, but it's killing this old woman and him. He sets her in the end. He goes and finds his hiking boots and thinks he'll go and see her. It's as though you won't, you're not let off, really. There's something that was unfinished.
Yeah.
The other thing about being primarily somebody who tries to write poems is that I've got very little patience with language which is merely instrumental, like plot language.
Yes, I was going to ask you about
to
that.
Get from A to B. And I know this. I mean, there are very great writers who, novelists particularly, who actually don't care much about the sentence, like Balzac, and this sort of rage of it, Dickens is quite like that as well. It's sort of the huge drive of it. But if you primarily write quite careful poems, then it's, to a degree which would be kind of shocking to people if people knew. I mean, I do actually care about the sort of things I care about in lines of verse, about just what kind of vowels are in play and what the rhythm of it is and all the rest of it.
Rhythm plays a part in short stories, though.
A lot, because it's got a sort of pulse to it, which you can feel in the short story. You can in some very great novels, the large pulses. I mean, Lawrence is interesting in this. You probably know he wrote Lady Chatterley 3 times. He didn't just sort of fiddle around with it. He did one version, out of sort of 70, 80, 90, 100,000 words, which he was not happy with. Has another go, another whole version. And he hated the idea of just sort of fiddling about with it. It's the whole sort of pulse.
Yeah.
And his long novels, like Women in Love, work like that, with images all the way along, the great sort of pulse.
Which is so rare in novels in general. That impulse is something. Jane and I were talking a little bit earlier this afternoon about that, the idea that in a short story there's very often this sense of a push towards one thing. There's, even if you have many elements working together, there's a directed sense of movement towards an end. Even if the end is irresolution, which it often is. But in a novel that's far less common as a rule, isn't it? I think Lawrence is maybe a great exception in that he probably bridges poetry,
yes,
short
he does.
Stories and the novel in a and very his, rare
his,
way.
His, well, he does. His short stories are perhaps the best thing of all, but they're very like their poems. And the characteristic of particularly the free verse poems is this coming at it and coming at it again and then saying it in nearly the same language again, but not quite. So he's perfectly conscious of this technique of near repetition, which suggests that the thing is so alive, you can't possibly fix it. The best you can do is just keep on in these extraordinarily precise approximations of what and that gives you then the feeling, which I'd hoped for in this, in some ways, that that what's going on exceeds the pages. I mean, that's, I suppose, is the kind of principle in a lot of this, is that, that is my axiom, that life exceeds art, and we ought to rejoice in the fact that life exceeds art. And the best kind of art celebrates the fact that it is itself exceeded.
Yeah.
The idea that you would compress it and tie it all up, and that then would count as...
That was something that I thought came through very strongly in many of the stories. And again, it's looping back to what I call narrative at the beginning. But the idea of renewal and new beginnings. Yeah. There's a very strong sense of hope coming through.
Well, I'm glad you think that, because... I suppose I'm a kind of famously lugubrious character in the immediate environment. But actually, I think of... the last one upsets me more. I mean, not the last one, sorry. The one called An Island.
Yes. Actually, I was going to say An Island and Fault were the two stories that I thought there was a sense in which characters were trapped by a narrative.
Yeah.
Of their own making.
And
the claustrophobia of that and the desperation of that. And with Fault, there's a strong sense of loss associated.
Yes, and he's not... I mean, he's had it, and she knows he's had it, and that's why she runs away, because she doesn't want trapping into this. And that's why she's very savage with him, a bit like, well, why didn't you hold it? If it mattered that much to you, why didn't you hold on to it? But in most of them, there's a strong utopian effort in people, in Alphonse and the others, which is kind of blackly comical, and in Gold, I'm quite fond of that. Even though mostly they end rather bleakly.
There's an anarchy.
There's an anarchy in
so
it.
The end of Goat and also The House by the Weir and the Way. You're drawing on Pan.
That's right. There's
a really great chaotic spirit.
Even if the characters, even if the characters themselves, even if the plot if the plot ends rather lugubriously, yeah. like in yet another old people's home or whatever, there's something which is loose.
Yeah, there's a surplus energy.
That's right, yeah. And,
something that struck me is you mentioned Weirs.
Yeah.
Not once, but definitely twice, possibly three times. And there's an extraordinary description in The House by the Weir and the Way, which made me think a lot of the short story and what it does. And I don't know, it's about a page long. I might see if I can read a paragraph.
It's the thing about the water coming out your slant.
Exactly, this word. And the sense of water, well, cross currents, but the sense it's of that, water working in two directions.
Yeah, I've watched these things for ages, and it is absolutely fascinating because it's Weirs that are slant across that do it most, obviously, because there's this sort of drift that way. At the same time, it's going that way, and you can see things like leaves borne along the very brim, which, if it were full on, would be taken over, but they survive on the brim.
And at a completely different pace.
Exactly, yeah.
And it takes into account, I mean, thinking about the short story form, it takes into account that double existence of something which is very, that can feel almost predetermined, a narrative drive, and also just different rhythms and eddies that appear and disappear and digressions, but all within.
That's right. I'm no musician, but it's a technique of sort of ritardando, which is that you know where it's going, but it's held back, as you say, and it's not only held back, but it's actually, it's coming at you slant, which to me is more like what life is than these straight lines.
And that incorporates a sense of something hitting you left field that you're not entirely able to prepare yourself because you don't see it coming. As a reader, I think that can happen with the reading experience in the short story. And there's also that you also say, I'm not going to read it all because it's such a long passage, but you talk about it feels like a residual and ineffectual will of one's own overwhelmed. The most you can say for yourself, good or bad, is that you did not go over without demur. I love that, the sense that there's a resistance.
Yeah.
And people have written about this idea of recalcitrance and resistance in the short story. And I do think in the sort of tensions that, certainly in the tensions here at the Midland in the title story, between the characters, in the narrative, in the temporal play, you start in the first two pages, the fact that you start with this wonderful description of the kite surfers, and then suddenly we're told that the story began beforehand with a discussion of paedophilia, which is now going to continue, and suddenly the whole thing is reframed.
Yeah.
So there's a wonderful sense of the convergence of different currents.
Well, it pleases me that you think that, because again, that's not something I mustn't make myself up some more kind of intuitive than I am. But I mean, I had no thought of, well, I've got to put that in first and I can go
and then
back
follow it up.
Because I wanted to start with without thinking about it. Actually, I mean, I really did. Once I got going, I did tend to write it out, and then once I've got the shape of it, it's like the shape of breathing, really. Once it's there, then I feel quite happy about it, and then go back and spend up to the ages. So in the end, I know them nearly by heart.
How much do you edit?
Well, I'd spend a lot of time fiddling about, but the main thing is to get this drive, and I write them, and then I type them up, and if it, like under the dam story in the first one. In the end, I was writing that so fast, I couldn't quite read my own. But it really, you know, and there was somebody coming. I knew that we're going to get visitors, and I heard them arrive, and I thought, Christ, if I finish this.
Maybe that's the ideal way to write a short story, knowing that it's going to end.
So it's about getting a shape, and then sometimes you realise it's wrong, and then it takes absolutely ages I'm a bit like what Lawrence said, you can't just sort of fiddle about. It's not going to help if you just rephrase one or other of the sentences. There's something you've lost the way, really, and I kind of like that image, because it's the same with writing poems, that the writing is that through which you begin to realise what the poem wants to say, and you don't know in advance, and you can mislead yourself to thinking it's going that
you
way.
You can wrong track yourself.
Then you wrong track yourself, that's a good word, yeah. And then you... there's a good point by Robert Graves about precisely that process, actually, about ignoring the warning lights, you're actually going wrong, but you, it's too late to come back, but you've actually gone wrong. And he says, burn it.
Just stop, let it go. Start over
and start all over again, really.
But that takes great bravery once you're into a story, doesn't it? And that even if you know that you've taken the wrong path.
Well, but you can feel it going wrong.
Yeah.
Because it's a process, and so you are actually listening. I mean, that's why you're listening to tones of voice and voices really, and then rhythms of that.
What do you do if you think this is
then
going
Well, I stop and try to go back to the point I was pretty sure about.
Where you were.
Yeah.
Yeah. And relocate yourself.
Then relocate yourself back in it, which is better if you can sort of get it right, even though you feel that, you know, there's loads, it's just, this is not good enough, this is not good enough, but at least it's going in the right direction.
Would you, going right back to the beginning of the conversation, you were talking about the idea of starting, needing to begin with either a strong image or a sense of a character.
Mm.
And I suppose those initial grains of ideas and the power that they can have, the sense of potential, are they something that you would write down?
No.
Because that interests me, whether that would kill an idea.
I've got them in my
yeah.
I've got them in my head. I keep a notebook the whole time, so I might, particularly for poems, although not as it were knowing that I'm going to write a poem, but I do write these things down that are very concretely pleasing and in some way significant, I think. And then it may be, but I've got a system of notebooks, which is means the likelihood of you being able to find what you wrote. It might be like 2 months ago or 25 years ago. It's quite hard.
So, haphazard notes. Yes.
Well, no, they are.
Are they chronological?
They're all chronological, but it's just that they're not typed. I can't sort of word search or whatever. Anyway.
Yeah.
By the Bible.
I was going to ask you. And this actually relates to what you were saying about the story Asylum and the fact that you'd had some personal experience there. I was going to ask you whether there are any subject areas that you would consider off limits so that you would feel... Because so often those subjects are the ones that really are very powerful and that as a writer drawn to.
Well, the things I've never written about, actually, are things I don't know anything about.
Yeah.
And things I think I have no right to.
Mm. And what would
well, I mean, for example, I can explain that very easily. Actually, the first time, when I felt quite sure of my wish to write poetry, not my ability, but my, you know, the fact that I was going to be doing it forever, when I started writing about my grandmother in the First World War, because her husband was killed in July 1916, and she then remained a widow for the rest of her life, and she lived with us, and she kind of brought us up. And towards the end of her life, she it was as though she was going back to him, and she would appear clutching these few, you know, they had a pay book and a couple of medals that they all got, and a notice from the king, and the notification of his death. And I thought, well, I know about that. But I also know in a different way about the First World War, because I've read millions of books on it, and I've read, you know, all the best accounts, and I've traipsed all over the battlefields and all the rest of it. But I never wanted to write about what it felt like being a soldier. Some have. I've never been in a war. I've never been shot at. I've got an imagination, and doubtless I could, you know, imagine what it's like. But I've always kept to what I know about. So off limits for me are those huge topics, which some people have felt is perfectly okay to do. My subject is German. That was what I taught for 31 years, so I know an awful lot about the First World War and the Second World War and the literature of Auschwitz and all the rest of it. And again, I could, in a sense, tell you what being in Auschwitz was like, in a sense.
But you wouldn't?
Well, when I say in a sense, it would mean I could give you a completely surface view, culled from all over the place, from various accounts of it. And I've never wanted to do that. And I couldn't do it. I mean, it's not a moral thing. It's just a... You know, I've said this on when I've had tutored on courses, keep to what you know, and people said in a quite outraged fashion, what about the imagination? You know, why do you not imagine things that you've never experienced? I can only say, going back to what I said before, I have to have my feet on the ground. I mean, I've got, I have to know about these things.
What about having one foot on what you know and one foot on a subject?
Well, you can go quite a long way if it's rooted. The character Anteos, remember, had, if you lifted him both feet off the ground, you could defeat him. But as long as he had one foot touching the earth, he was a wrestler.
Yeah.
Then he was unbeatable. And that's a good image of it as well. So you can do quite a lot. I mean, the story about another country, I've never fallen down a glacier, but the story is a very potent one. I set a story in my mother and father's house, the attic, which is full of stuff like that. The story Island is set on Briar, where we have a house. So it's a location which is, which I know intensely.
Yeah.
I mean, I know every boulder practically there. So. And all the people in it, there are types of, you know, people who drift in and out of island community, and they do odd jobs, particularly men of a certain age. They blow in and they blow out again. And I know a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
The story, incidentally, is I translated Goethe's Werther, The Sorrows of Young Werther, and the essence of that is extraordinarily simple, absolutely masterly narrative stroke is to keep the correspondence one-sided.
Mm.
Nothing survives.
Nothing comes back.
So it's an image. It's a narrative technique which is a metaphor of his whole predicament, namely this sort of solipsistic.
Yeah, so and that comes across very powerfully because it's the longest story.
In Werther, nothing. But she is there, and he refers to letters coming from his friend Wilhelm. All the rest of it. So I simply intensified that.
Mm.
And in this, we've no reason to think she ever writes back.
Mm.
So they're all going out. Now, I've had it, the two very close women friends, my wife and another close woman friend, both read that and said, well, you can't let him kill himself.
Not acceptable.
Because he's so full of life. But the poignant thing about Werther is precisely that he's a valuable human being. He loves kids, he likes women, he's in touch with nature, he's got a sensibility which the society is the poorer if it won't accommodate, and it doesn't. At the same time, he's got this, you know, this manic, in the end, self-destructive, solipsistic, no egress. So I really wanted to talk in that. And there are several characters in these stories who are absolutely full of life.
Yeah.
At the same time, they could just flip on a coin like that and it's all finished. I mean,
yeah.
You know. The whole structure is untenable, as I think he says. In the end, I couldn't do it, he said. But he's massively interested in other people. He's got everything going for him, in a way. I mean, the story is full of stories, of, you know, bits of stories of other people that he's written down. He's gone to the trouble of, because they interest him. So he's really connected at the same time.
Yeah, there's a mosaic of other lives.
That's right, there is.
And yet the one person he wants to hear back from.
He doesn't. And suddenly, or perhaps that's not, it's a bit like the character in Fault. Perhaps there is some sort of... You know, there are certain people that, in the end, no amount... Well, there's a character in the Büchner's play, Dante's Talk. He walks very carefully. He says that the earth has a very thin crust. She tiptoes around. I quite often feel like that.
There's also a sense in those stories of it's a very wistful sense of... looking into other people's lives that have been lived.
Yeah.
So that sense of dislocation that you were talking about earlier and dispossession, as if something perhaps should have happened, but it hasn't.
Yeah.
And no amount of wanting it is going to make it happen.
Yeah.
So in narrative terms, you have a powerful sense of loss, which just grows and keeps growing.
Yeah.
And so An Island is the title of the story. It leaves you feeling utterly bereft.
I'm sorry.
No, I mean, it's a wonderful read, but because of that, I suppose the short form can do this. Your sense of involvement as a reader and the fact that you know it's going to end, you're being taken by the hand to a determined end, and it's heartbreaking. There's a very strong sense of loss because you're hoping with the character who you're hugging the whole way through that maybe...
Well, the equivalent story in Under the Dam is the man, the young man in there.
Mm.
He's got everything there, really, and suddenly he can't do it. And I've known lots of people like that. I mean, they're absolutely full of life, and suddenly it's as though all the time it's been a kind of tightrope. Not lots of people, I've known several. There is something that's very precarious in people, very, very precarious.
And often that's very hard to articulate, which is why And these sort of explorations are so, they're so powerful for getting close to that. And I think short stories do that very well, where you're trying to pay attention to something and to articulate it, even in part. Mm. And it's not something that you're going to be able to fully articulate.
Which is quite a relief in that form allows it. You don't have to explain in all directions who all these people are and where it all ended. Mm. And I suppose that's going back to what I said earlier about this very strong belief that life exceeds art. And so if you must never just reiterate your techniques, but the technique of beginning bits of life by listening in on other people's stories or writing them down. Mm. Obviously, the idea of that is just to suggest that there is this huge sort of continuum of life. One image that I think was used of Carver is, or perhaps it wasn't, perhaps something else, is where you just dip, no, it was somebody else in America, you just dip into the flux and you hold on this, and it's like you might pond dipping or something, you dip, but the thing itself is just flowing, you pass and you hold it up. And you're under no obligation, in fact, you're under an obligation not to try to stop it.
But you have, as part of that, a sense of the momentum of
the momentum, yeah. And it's not like spearing, pinning butterflies on it. It's not that, because you try to write in such a way that... This is why the rhythm of sentences is so important. So there's got to be something in it that suggests onward drive. Mm. And it's slowed enough for you for it to be made palpable.
Mm.
But actually the drive is not exactly headlong, but it's certainly not in a halt because for anybody's convenience.
And those references or inferences of a before and an after the story, which can work so well within the story on the page.
Well, that's that again, yeah. I mean, it's exactly, there is a before and an after, which you can hint at. And, I love 19th century novels, but I hate really the idea that you've got to fill everything before and then where it's all going. And then, how they would then say who married who and the end and all the rest of it. It's a quite sweet thing, though. Because there is a sort of curiosity in the reader that wants to know.
Well, I sometimes think for dissatisfied readers of short stories who want that detail, that you could almost publish a book with short stories in the first half and then the whole of the second half being those charts and family trees and all the names that weren't included, just a series of footnotes to exactly which detail they wanted.
Well, you get that Zola does that. I mean, there's the Hugo Macar thing. He really did work it all out with all the interconnections. And then you get books, which are dictionaries of the characters.
But one of the great pleasures of short stories for me is specifically that absence of information. Because as a reader, I want to be active.
Yeah.
And I want to be allowed to play my part.
Yeah.
So I get cross if I get told too much. I'm going to ask you one final question because I think I need to release you for your event. Well, this is actually a very common question, but it would be interesting to know which contemporary short story writers you really admire.
I'd rather not say among my immediate contemporaries, but I've read an awful lot of William Trevor and a lot of Elizabeth Bowen. Carver I've read a good deal of. But I have to say, I mean, I read them mostly with a sense of pleasure that these things are being done, but not by me. I suppose you just get very... You start to read in a kind of professional way, don't you? That you kind of seeing how he has managed. I read Jean Rhys recently, the short stories, which I think are extraordinary. Catherine Mansfield I like as well, and just this attention to detail that actually matters. It's not that the thing is cluttered with detail, but it's having an eye to see and then retain, but actually just remembering what somebody was wearing, and fabrics, and just the general texture of things is extraordinarily good.
As a reader, you can be bowled over by those small details when they're spot on.
Yeah,
that's something extraordinary. That's a very strong sense of connection.
That's
and often the humour, I find, that... Yeah. The smallest detail, if it's accurate, can make you feel... there's a sort of warmth, I suppose, that it generates.
What you don't want is it to be cluttered. And I think you also have to remember that the eye is actually labours to put details together.
Mm.
If you just look at something, then it's all there simultaneously. You take it in. But if I were to describe this room, I'd have to do it chronologically, the one detail following another. And the effort of putting that back together in the mind's eye is colossal. And in the end, you you would not be able to do it.
It wouldn't be a true impression.
Well, you couldn't actually fix the spatial relations of everything in this room. What that you just take in like that.
Mm.
Which is why passages of descriptive prose have got to be doing something very definitely other than trying to say what this thing just looks like. I suppose that's pleasing about the story as well, isn't it? In a good story, it does actually all belong. You wouldn't really want to do without any of it.
Mm. Well, thank you so much
for talking.
And I must thank Small Wonder, Charleston Trust,
for hosting
this as well.
Thank you. Thanks very much.